Thanks, Mike, and nice to be in Glasgow, and good afternoon. What you should have in front of you is one side of A4 with six slides on. That's the reassuring bit, it's only six slides. And the second piece of paper information is the research bulletin, which any TLRP project produces fairly early on in the career of a research project, when it's meant to be a way in which a whole variety of audiences can get to grips with what the research is trying to do. And it's also meant to signal some preliminary findings. So by all means, use that as a guide to some of the issues I'd like to explore. You'll also find on the bulletin the web address for our project, and there you'll find working papers which reflect some aspects of the project which I'm not going to talk about. So I'm going to focus on policy and system level stuff, and I'm going to focus on the English and what E.P. Thompson called the peculiarities of the English. So there's always Scotland and there's always Wales and there's other bits of that part of Europe. But I want to focus on England. In fact, I found myself spending more and more time trying to understand the English. Arguably, it's now a full-time academic occupation because the frenzy of policy and its degrees of coherence and incoherence, particularly if you're trying to understand things synoptically, right? Going across education and training and other learning activities beyond school. Many people still stick with a particular bit of the system and try to capture an understanding that way. So I'm going to try and go wide, and I hope it will be interesting comparatively, internationally, as well as a focus on a particular nation state and a particular setting. Okay. The other thing you should know about the seven projects which were commissioned and funded by the ESRC is that they're all on England. And the reason for that is that the Funding Council for Higher Education in England put up the money, gave the money to the Research Council to manage the projects. So there's an interesting geopolitics around the way in which those projects happened. But many of them are much broader than simply a look at England and its ways. Okay. We have a deceptively simple research question. And it's on your slide, and it's there. So our project, which is quite an ambitious one, a multi-level design, looking at international, national, regional, local dimensions of relationships which the English and other Anglophile examples would describe as something called higher education over there and something called further education, vocational education, community-related education of various forms over there in a common landscape called post-secondary, post-compulsory education. So we're asking a question about why the English make that separation, have invested in that separation, and why it survives as a demarcation, a separation of territories based on types of institutions, types of students, types of programs, types of activity, with different regimes funding them, quality assuring them, collecting data about them, different governance relationships for staff, different conditions of service, and we could continue across a whole variety of ways in which we have that separation very strongly expressed in English arrangements. So the first part of what I'd like to do is to explore the modern architecture of sectors. How did that happen? When did it happen? And what, if anything, was the rationale for making that division, historically, politically, or in policy terms? And then what most of our project was about is that if you make that division, what are the implications for strategies of trying to widen participation for both young people and adults into undergraduate education? What kind of division of labour is presupposed? And why is it a division of labour? And can that division of labour hold? Does the shift to mass higher education and a potential shift to near universal access undermine such divisions, such structures? And does it matter? Okay, so this plays into theoretical arguments about the relationship between growth in higher education systems and degrees of diversity, differentiation, and stratification, which in turn plays into arguments about the social effects of distributing students in differentiated, stratified systems of further and higher education. So a lot of scholarship, a lot of theory and writing around those relationships. But at the policy level, there is a very interesting dilemma in England, which is about the degree to which this division is sustained. But is that division a source of democratisation in post-compulsory education, as access to higher forms of learning are more plural, are more open? Or do we see diversionary tendencies, the steering of certain kinds of students into certain kinds of programmes in certain kinds of institutions with certain kinds of social and economic outcomes? Okay? So that argument has played strong in Scotland, because in Scotland you have a very clear, clean distinction between a further education system, sector, service, territory, which does a discrete band of sub-bachelor higher education. And that is a discrete mission for colleges. Whereas on the other side of a sectoral division, the universities are playing mainly to bachelor level and postgraduate work. So there you have a division of labour which is reflected in sectoral terms, which is fairly clear, fairly distinct, and arguably is a form of tight stratification, differentiation, particularly institutional form and type and governance and funding and so on. In England, it's fuzzy and it's complex. And that's what I'd like to open up with you. What the hell is going on in the English experience of mass and post-mass higher education, where further education is being brought into the sphere of high-level qualifications, high-level training, high-level education? We have people fighting back in the... if you want to fight back in the front, that's fine. But let's see how we go. Is that okay as a kind of scene setting? Good. I wanted to try and encourage us to think about Anglo-Scottish, Scottish-English, Scotland-England comparisons, as well as wider ones, because I think, as I will suggest, the Scottish experience did play into the way in which the English have tried to reshape their system. Okay. This project, as I said, is multi-level. Now, the bit I'm going to talk about is the system and policy level stuff, but we also looked at the organisations of further and higher education, particularly where they were hybrid organisations. In other words, they were doing both further and higher education in different shapes, sizes, institutional and organisational forms. And we were trying to typologise that and look for directions of change, if there were any obvious directions of change. And then, at the micro level, working with staff and students in those institutions, we worked with four partner organisations. Two of them were in the further education sector, and they did higher education. Two of them were in the higher education sector, and they also did further education. Okay, so you see an interesting overlap in further and higher education in the English experience, even though the amount of higher education which is taught in further education is much less than in Scotland. So in Scotland, we're, what? Over a third of the system is located in another sector. So the higher education system is a dual system in a higher education presence and a further education presence for different levels and types of higher level qualification. In England, it's only about 1 in 10. But the English experiment, as I'm going to style it, is about growing higher education in further education settings and using both market and central government intervention as a way of both steering and incubating that kind of change. But the bigger experiment is the attempt in England to change the pattern of demand, which historically has been mainly expressed for full-time, bachelor-level, higher education. That is how the English went from a semi or extended elite system into mass proportions of higher education participation. They did it on the old model. In Scotland, you have a contrasting trajectory for expansion, where the colleges with sub-baccalaureate qualifications were a major element in the early achievement of mass levels of participation. So contextually, I think that's a good place to start. So let's look at the English experiment and the components within it. Now, you rarely find this expressed in policy documents or in policy talk. But since 1997, since the Deering Inquiry, which was a UK-wide inquiry, looked at the future of higher education over the next 20 years, you've seen in England a deliberate attempt by government not to follow the path taken previously in the shift to mass higher education. So a deliberate attempt to change the shape and scope of the system, to try and grow and steer future demand much more towards short cycle vocational forms of higher education, rather than, as previously, the traditional trajectory associated with the full-time mode, the intensive three-year degree leading to a bachelor's qualification, normally study full-time. Now, that was always the primary model with lots of diversity around it, but it was the hegemonic form of English higher education, which still survives in the branding of the English system for international purposes. Okay. Changing the pattern of demand for undergraduate education, but using interventions on the supply side to try and trigger and steer future demand. So I'll look at some examples of that. So the English came to mass higher education late. They did it in what Peter Scott described as a fit of absent-mindedness. In other words, it happened in a short period of time under quasi-market conditions, managed markets by a Thatcher government, where institutions could not afford not to expand. If you did not expand, there would be financial penalties of you standing still. But the consequence of you expanding was that there was a lowering of the unit of resource for teaching. So there was a very smart calculation by senior civil servants which produced a funding model which the system responded to by producing demand based on a managed market, intense competition for marginal funding. And marginal funding got you more students, but it also meant that your overall resource base was either stable or slightly enhanced. But overall, the unit of resource for teaching was reduced. So the government view of that was efficient expansion. Deering looked at it and talked about underfunding of higher education, not just for the teaching function, but also for the research function. And of course, the English indulged in things which the Scots did not. What did the fastest growing part of higher education do, the polytechnics, when they reach capacity to absorb future expansion on their own campuses? They subcontracted the teaching out. Who to? Colleges. Now, that was partly a function of the need to keep expansion going and at the same time having the resource base, the space, to actually teach. So there you see the growth of what became known as franchising in higher education, which was a specifically English creation, although there were Welsh and Northern Irish examples at the same time. But very few developed examples in Scotland because of that division of labour I spoke about initially. So here you have some quite interesting market forms, hybrid forms of higher education, which are emerging out of a frenzy of expansion, the lurch to expansion. So between the late 1980s and the early 1990s, the English went from 15% participation to 30%. They doubled the participation rate. And the system grew by about three quarters in 10 years. Now, that was way behind the participation rates in Scotland, but the actual pace of expansion wasn't just rapid, it was also unplanned. So franchising was an expression of a more market-related environment, the need to expand, and the need to keep your expansion curve growing, and using subcontracted forms of higher education to massify both the numbers within institutions and at the system level. So unlike in Scotland, where the colleges, I think, were the fastest and most significant part of the system to grow in the shift from early to middle forms of mass higher education, in England, the shift to mass higher education was led by higher education institutions. And it was the polytechnics, which were then owned by local government, not by central government, which led that expansion, followed by the established universities, which were funded through a funding committee from central government. The colleges of further education were the slowest part of the system of higher education to expand. So there you had expansion, as I said, on the old model, and arguably, people have said, on a high-cost model. High cost in the unit of resource for teaching, although that was eroding, but high cost because of the focus on full-time study with a mix of grant and loans featuring the support for students who are studying full-time forms of undergraduate education. And for that reason, it collapsed. So in 1994, a funding crisis led to a halt to any expansion in England. And that was the trigger for the Deering inquiry to get the government out of a funding difficulty. How do you grow the system? How do you renew growth? How do you establish a more stable and secure financial base for both the teaching and the research functions, which had been under pressure as a result of a major form of underfunded, underplanned, and little coordinated expansion? So that's the backdrop to the Deering Committee and to the English experiment, as I style it, because that was not the route to be taken in future expansion. And whereas that previous expansion was, to some degree, if not to a large degree, student-led, right? Full-time subsidy to a degree, full-time study, and a traditional set of institutions, new and old, taking those students on a traditional set of qualifications, mainly, but not only, but mainly the bachelor degree at the honours level. Okay? So there was a rejection of that trajectory for the next phase of expansion, which was, you can see that I'm never sure where this machine is located, so I will twirl around a lot. Let's go back to and understand the late 1980s, when this expansion took off. Because it was at that time that the modern architecture of sectors in England was established legally and constitutionally. Now, up until the late 1980s, you had a binary system of higher education, which meant basically a university system which was more autonomous in its rights and responsibilities, its constitutionality, its governance, and funded directly by government but at arm's length, although that arm's length becoming shorter and shorter during the 1980s as government steering became stronger on the universities, imposing cuts, as you may remember, in the early 1990s on parts of the higher education university system. That's one side of the binary line in those days, which goes back to the 1960s. The other half was called further education. But in that further education sector system, you had both a higher education function, which then was styled advanced further education, and what we probably recognise more today as education below the undergraduate level, which were styled non-advanced further education, and that was styled generally, generically, further education, or increasingly styled in that way. Now, in England, despite the local government system using central government money, but being passed through the local authorities to both own and control the institutions they rooted that funding into, there was still always an attempt by central government to concentrate the provision of higher education in what was then the one further education system. So by the time you get to the 1980s, the polytechnics and the higher education bits of further education were doing more and more higher level work. And they were dropping their non-advanced work. And there were more colleges who were doing mainly, only, further education level work below higher education. So you had that secular trend, partly a result of deliberate attempt by central government to rationalise and concentrate provision, but also as a result of the active development of the polytechnics as the flagship institutions who would be rivaling and sought to rival the universities as providers of bachelor and postgraduate education. Okay, so you see upward academic mobility in the case of polytechnics, and that was part of a binary policy, a deliberate policy to take what were sometimes called the senior positions, institutions in the further education world, and enable them to mature under the tutelage of a national agency, the Council for National Academic Awards, which will award their degrees until a point in which they achieved degrees of regulatory independence and maturity in order to award their own degrees. And of course, the government eventually, in the middle of this expansion, in the early 1990s, chose to abandon the binary divide, chose to enable the polytechnics to take the university title and to award their own degrees. So after 30 years, or nearly 30 years of conscious self-development part of the higher education system in the further education system became more and more discrete, leaving the rest of further education increasingly focusing on lower level work. Lower level in the sense of non-higher education work. In 1988, that formally got recognised by the polytechnics being removed from local government and given their own funding council, funding them for higher education. Now, that meant a large part of the further education system moved out of further education and became part of a discrete higher education territory. And then in 1992, the old division between universities and polytechnics was formalised in a unified system, new university titles of polytechnics, so formal unification, but at the same time, the creation of a further education sector which was also taken away from the control of local government and created as a separate sector with its own funding council, its own quality assurance arrangement in parallel with the higher education system. Now, the research I was involved in was to interview the senior civil servants who were the architects of those bits of legislation. And I've interviewed all the chief executives of the subsequent heads of the funding and quality bodies in each sector, all the way through to the present. And I've asked them our research question. How do you understand the division which was created as a result of the 1988 and 1992 legislation? How do you understand that as architects of that system? And secondly, how do you understand it as chief executives and senior managers running the regimes of further education on one side, as we have now, and higher education on the other? And the first question was about whether there was a rationale for that kind of division. In other words, was there an overarching justification? Was there a view, a vision, even an argument? Because in public, there isn't. What drove those changes were more particular and specific sets of changes, highly political, which were affecting parts of the system. And they were mainly affecting higher education. So things were happening to further education. It was losing its higher education. It was also increasingly being viewed as residual, what was left. But interestingly, there was no overarching view about, well, what are the relative functions and purposes in maintaining this division? And it's extremely interesting when you ask a leader of a further education national body to propose a rationale and justification or answer a question about what is the purpose, system purpose of further education. It's always one which baffles international students as well as international scholars. In fact, you know, one could spend all one's life going to conferences to explain the English and the nature of these strange inflections of division, but also constantly reinforcing that kind of division. So here you have an episode which gives us the modern architecture of sectors, but no rationale for what is the relationship between them. And they have a taken-for-grantedness in the English system, such that it's not raised as a set of questions, either in private debate, either within government departments, or within and between the regimes which are funding and regulating those two bits of the system. And our argument was, does that necessarily, therefore, have effects in relation to an attempt to consciously break that assumption, to actually grow higher education in a sector which the 1988 and 1992 legislation was meant to not have as part of its presence? So after 1992, there was meant to be a division of labour which was by level of learning. Colleges did below undergraduate education. Anything from upper secondary through to basic, other forms of tertiary education and training, but not higher education. Higher education was to be concentrated in institutions which had that purpose in another sector. But the most powerful rationale of all, and is now compromised by the English experiment, was the assumption that higher education was best provided in institutions which were primarily involved in higher education, as defined in English terms. Because, of course, if we were in a North American context, we'd understand higher education as synonymous largely with post-secondary education. Whereas the English are preoccupied with drawing a sharp boundary, or as sharp as possible, in demarcating a certain idea with an essentialist core of what an English idea of higher education should be, and trying to represent that and protect it and reinforce it with the idea of an institutional form, a university or a higher education establishment. Very little worry about further education institutions having an organic purpose, shape, form. Very much, again, it was the other sector which would function and adopt and adapt and respond to all the other sets of conditions which are source of the turbulence outside of higher education and beyond schooling. So we have this assumption that from the beginning, certain kinds of institutions should be mainly concerned with further or higher education. That was the assumptive architecture. And then with Deering and with the new Labour government elected in 1997, we have the policy turn. And this is where the Scottish experience fed into the Deering inquiry. There was a separate Scottish committee within the Deering inquiry anticipating devolution or devolved sets of arrangements. And you saw that in the way in which Deering made recommendations for the different territories, the different countries of the UK. And of course, England, as the larger slice of the activity, received disproportionate treatment in relation to a new special mission for the colleges. So Deering made the assumption that future demand would be expressed not at the bachelor level, but more and more as lifelong learning played into people's decisions and lifelong decisions, that short cycle forms of higher education, flexible part-time, offered in different places, but connected either through credit or formal sets of relationships between institutions, that would be increasingly, Deering anticipated, the form of future demand. And that is why the colleges were expected to have a more larger purpose in that part of higher education. And of course, the other side of that was widening participation, as local institutions always functioning as second, third, fourth chance environments, they would be able to perform that dual function of being close to local employment and labour market requirements locally and regionally, and at the same time performing a transfer function for some students who do their short cycle higher education in colleges, who might complete to the bachelor's and other levels in other institutions. So that's the first element in the policy turn, in the English experiment, the attempt to change future demand, to shift it. Or as the white paper in 2003 said, to break the dominant pattern of demand. That was the only time you find a public statement of this quite important, powerful purpose, which brings together the incoherent sets of activities which seem to be a feature of the English experience. And the other thing which soon happened, partly because demand wasn't expressed for short cycle higher education, nor for college-based higher education when the Deering proposals were implemented in England. And the response by government was to invent a new qualification. And it was invented from above. And it was the first new major higher education qualification since the 1970s, where the diploma of higher education was also invented to become a short cycle liberal broad qualification, sitting below the bachelor degree. But here you have the invention of not just a new qualification, the foundation degree, but the first time in English history where the notion of a degree has been expressed outside of the bachelor location. So these are very significant, on the one hand, deregulatory moments or significant attempts to intervene in order to engineer new forms of demand. And the third source of complexity in this experiment relates to who's going to do the foundation degree. Do you give it to the colleges as their qualification, in the way higher nationals are a college qualification in Scotland? Or do you see it as a shared territory between universities offering that short cycle qualification as well as colleges? And the answer is, in England, it was always going to be a shared function. Why? Because there was more short cycle higher education still being done by the universities than by the colleges. So despite the attempt to concentrate more and more higher level work in the newer universities, the ex-polytechnics and colleges of higher education, it was still the case that they were doing significant amounts of sub-bachelor work. So the colleges never had a special mission, which Deering had offered them and invited them to lead. And we'll come to reasons why that didn't happen in a minute. But what did happen was that the Deering recommendation was actually changed. Because demand wasn't being expressed for short cycle higher education, nor for the college located stuff under that area, one solution was a new qualification to try and drive up demand. The other was to try and bring colleges into relationship with universities in order to increase the brand, increase the status, and stimulate demand. It's a university qualification awarded by an institution empowered to award a degree, but it's mainly taught, or solely taught, in a college location. So what you see is a move away from the idea of funding colleges directly, as in Scotland, for their higher education, and a preference in England for indirect funding, which was the market response during the rapid period of expansion, franchising. So what was seen by Deering as a sinful activity, franchising, he talked about serial franchising, the dangers to quality and standards of universities and colleges getting into multiple relationships on the basis of subcontracting their teaching function. Deering disliked that intensely. And as a result, his preference was directly funding the colleges to grow higher education. The response by the new Labour government, after demand not being expressed for that kind of higher education, was, as I said, a new qualification which could be funded directly, but the preference of government was to ask colleges to get into structured partnerships with universities. And that is the dominant form. Okay, so of the 1 in 10 students studying higher education, About a third of them have the funding for their courses directly by a higher education body. A third of those students, it's complex, are funded through franchising from a university institution. In other words, these students are owned by that institution. If you wanted to sue anybody, it's the university which would have to take the responsibility. So the responsibility for the total quality assurance of the student experience for a franchise student is not where they're taught, but where they're registered. So here you have a very interesting quasi-legal relationship, which was never challenged in the courts, but was always open to difficulty. And there was a market in those relationships, because different universities would offer different deals for partnerships, and still do. So how much you took in a top slice for the services you performed as the university, quality assurance, you might be involved in admissions, you might be involved in other functions. Right? The universities took roughly between 10 and 35% top slicing of the money they received for the teaching function, so the colleges would have a lower unit of resource to perform the teaching function. And that's interesting, because the Deering requirement, and it's still currently the dominant principle, unlike Scotland, is that irrespective of where higher education is offered by a publicly funded institution, there will be a common level of resource for that qualification. Now, in Scotland, there's been a lower unit of resource for higher education in the college sector, comparatively, in relation to what equivalent levels of undergraduate education were funded in the higher education sector. And that's clearly exercising the Joint Funding Council at present. In England, in order to, as David Watson put it, control the quality range, maintain the brand, you've had an attempt to fund higher education, irrespective of where it's offered, at a common unit of resource. But franchising, of course, disrupts that, because the full resource is not transferred to the college for the teaching function. So a third of those students are under those contract-type conditions. So they're a University of Huddersfield student, but they're taught at a Leeds college under a franchise relationship. And the third kind of student is a student who's funded by the further education sector for its higher education. Now, this is the bit no one has previously understood. It has an arcane language of non-prescribed higher education. The negative is important, non-prescribed. So it's those bits of higher education which got left behind for the further education sector to keep funding, but nobody bothered with it, largely. But now, of course, the attempt to grow higher education in colleges means that these sources of funding become more interesting. But what they're offered for is higher-level professional qualifications. So people doing, for example, technical accountancy qualification, level 4, right? That will be funded by a further education sector body. So you've got three kinds of funding. You've got colleges not being able to make their own awards, so they've got to get into relationship with a university for the awarding function, or a national awarding examination body like EdExcel. And they are dependent sometimes for their student numbers from that partnership, which is a franchise one, to get some money to perform the teaching function. So that's the kind of market conditions, competitive conditions, which give an interest to colleges to get involved in this, as well as some universities. And lastly, I called it semi-compulsory. Basically, the only way in which you can grow your higher education, if you're a college these days, is to do it under a partnership arrangement. Direct funding to the colleges is a non-priority area for both the Funding Council and for government. And the other interesting thing which has happened is a not insignificant number of mergers between the two sectors of institutions. Further education colleges in whole transferring into a university framework, coming under the constitutional arrangements of a university. The result is that the largest university in England, outside of the Open University, which is a UK university, has more further education students than it does higher education students. So you have these very interesting new configurations, right? In other words, a large further education college merging with a previously established higher education institution changes the shape of that institution immediately and changes the way in which the concept of a university or the concept of a comprehensive university or the ability of an organisation to manage previously separate and sectorally separate systems. So I hope that gives you a sense of the degree to which there's the deliberate attempt to turn policy here, but under highly problematic sets of conditions. And the college interest is to derive additional streams of funding. Resource dependence theory would predict college behaviour. They are maximising multiple sources of funding wherever they are. They're acting in a market-like way, and they are equally adept at being agile in who they decide to work with as partners. And universities on their part clearly need colleges for a whole variety of reasons. It may well be to do with capacity. It may well be to do with getting their widening participation numbers in. Because if the universities are registering these students, even though they're taught in a further education college, they will get the widening participation premium on top of the unit of resource for teaching them, because the majority of these students are from neighbourhoods which would geographically and socially define them in that kind of location. Okay, I should stop soon, shouldn't I? Okay, quickly. And no one has stopped, so where is it? Here. Okay. So let's end here. And try to return to some research questions and some theoretical debates and international debates. What's interesting about the English example is that you have the survival of sector arrangements at the same time as you have a conscious model, a government model, of trying to move more higher education into the other sector, which should not happen on the assumptive base of the original architecture. So it's matter out of place. Colleges have been rediscovered as sites of higher education, but it's ambivalent. Colleges are ambivalent about this. Government is ambivalent about it, and the market is ambivalent. Is this real higher education? Or is it higher education for certain kinds of activity, for certain kinds of people? So, in terms of theory, are we seeing some conscious steering and directing of a new generation of students in relation to new sets of qualifications which have yet to establish their credibility and standing? And those qualifications are highly work-focused, reflecting a partnership between the employer, the university as the awarding authority, and the college as the main provider of teaching. But at the same time as we have sectors alive and well, we have combinations of further ed and higher education happening in common institutional settings. New hybrid forms emerging in the English case. Not without problems. And of course we have high policy, right? Colleges growing their higher education has moved from no policy to high policy. Lots of attempts to stimulate demand and encourage that development. But the actual yield in terms of growth has been quite small. In other words, demand is still being taken largely by the higher education sector institutions. So that 1 in 10 figure hasn't moved. So 10 years ago, roughly similar proportion were being taught in further education colleges when the system didn't even legitimate the idea that they could be taught in those settings. Then you move policy, you rev up to high policy, and the shift has still yet to be seen. Hence, there's a view perhaps that higher education in college settings is seen neither as normal or necessary. There is still a strong ambivalence about, let alone ignorance, of the existence of that territory of higher education. Thirdly, colleges and universities are meant to be collaborating in order to perform that function, but they're also competing for the same pool of students, many of them. So here you have very interesting public-private relations and collaborative competitive relationships, all intersecting in similar institutional contexts, often at a local and regional level. And finally, to return to broader sociological arguments, the degree to which the English case is one in which you see a broader democratisation of access as a result of the expansion of the location of higher education, the creation of new kinds of qualification, and the support for widening participation in terms of either a funding premium or as policies for collaborating and reaching out to new communities for higher education. Or, and this is where the English steering of demand is a very interesting one, the degree to which we see conscious diversion here. Now, playing against that would be the small nature of the activity. In other words, the core function of higher education is still not being shifted in its centre of gravity away from the main higher education sector institutions. And of course, it's the newer universities who are performing on a more widening participation front than other sets of institutions in that sector. But the colleges have not upped their game in relation to a legitimate and high-profile leadership in certain kinds of short-cycle higher education. So on the one hand, you haven't had the kind of numerical growth which would make diversion a more significant issue than it might be at present. But certainly you see both conscious and directed forms of higher education in relation to particularly older students who are in work and who are the subject of skills-related sets of modern policies. The other reason why diversion is probably less significant is the degree to which the foundation degree is a dual-function qualification. In the way in which the higher national diploma, its predecessor, if you like, also started out life as a labour market qualification, highly work-focused and locally related, and increasingly became an intermediate qualification for many students on the way to a bachelor degree. And you see the same function reproduced in the form of the foundation degree. Roughly half the students who achieve the foundation degree continue immediately to the bachelor degree. So there's a degree to which you're not having closure around a new qualification performing work-focused functions. But there is an issue, of course, about the degree to which the kinds of bachelor degree to which they are able to move on to may well reproduce certain kinds of institutional status and forms of higher education which might be recognised as diversion. I'm going to stop there because that's an attempt to give you a flavour of a very complex English context in which further and higher education remain separate territories with their own regimes, and with little or no debate about the possibility of more overarching set of machineries, such as in Scotland, which might actually begin to integrate that system and take it into a more tertiary form. Thank you.